In our political commentators today, Gareth Hughes and Bridget Morton. Kia ora kōrua.
Morena.
Kia ora, morena.
Gareth is a former Green MP, now works for the Wellbeing Economy Alliance, Aotearoa, no longer a member of any political party. Bridget's director with public and commercial law firm Franks Ogilvy and a former senior ministerial advisor for the previous National-led government, a National Party member and also volunteers during election time for the party's deputy leader, Nicola Willis. Who's budget is up this Thursday, and what is riding on this, Gareth?
Well, there's the perennial question, what kind of meal will Nicola have before the budget? Which I imagine she won't be wearing a tie, but what colour clothing I'm sure will be the topic. But I think for National, right, there's some huge challenges facing them. They've got to do all the stuff at the same time. They've framed it entirely around tax, so they have to deliver the tax promise. They have to do this without somehow being inflationary. They have to fund this somehow without debt, which the OECD warned the country about recently, or at least not have a bit of a switch around where that the savings funds the tax cuts, but the new spending is funding out of debt, because that's tax cuts for debt by any other name. And then they've also got to do it in a meaningful amount for people, that it's not just seen as a chewing gum budget. So it's a bit of an invidious position Nicola's made for herself, and it's going to be fascinating to see how she squares that circle.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think it's a very tough job ahead of this week, and I think you can see some of the shaping of that narrative about the fact of the tough economic conditions that they inherited, what has actually happened in the last 6 months as well. I think also the biggest thing for them is that they said very squarely, you know, down the line for the squeezed middle, that relief is coming. So those tax cuts is one part of that, but I think you've got to look at the wider picture. So that family boost policy around childcare, what they're doing around housing. I will probably get onto the first home buyers grant shortly, but I think in terms of more supply, getting things happening, that's what people are going to be looking for as well.
Look, that argument about whether you're borrowing for the tax cuts, it does become a head spinner in the end, but it is difficult to say, isn't it, if you think of your own budget, that you're spending this and there's a gap and you have to borrow, therefore you're borrowing for one thing or not another. You're either in the position of borrowing or not borrowing.
Yeah, I think that's true, but I think that's mostly, to be honest, an argument that's happening, you know, at the higher levels. Mm-hmm. I think most people don't care really where the money's coming from, as long as it's not coming from their back pocket. And you know, I did see that there was a taxpayer union courier poll that sort of tried to sort of navigate its way through this question and asking people, and they sort of said, yeah, we want tax cuts, but 58% wanted you know, they're not to come from cuts and new spending and not savings, not from more debt. But I'm not sure if most people truly understand nor frankly care that much about that, as long as they say they're not paying it from their bottom line.
Well, the other thing is that the finance minister has achieved her target, I think, of $1.5 billion of savings through these cuts to the public service. In fact, she's indicating things might continue along that line.
Yeah, that's true, but people are also seeing the impacts of those cuts, you know, the weekly sort of layoffs in the public service, or reading recovery last week, or customs, you know, agents. It feels very unstrategic, though. You know, you talk to people involved in the public sector in Wellington in particular, and I think people in the rest of the country care about what's happening in the public service, because it's not just Wellington, of course, where the jobs are happening. But it's not strategic. It's not surgical. It's across the board. And yeah, People are seeing those perverse cuts. So this is Nicola Willis and Luxon's challenges. The framing around the budget is all around kind of an austerity vibe, around cuts, layoffs. They've got to try and switch that around.
I think that same poll or another one did not find a great deal of, some people said, actually, yeah, I want deeper cuts to the to those numbers, because it's an easy target, isn't it, when you're suffering in your own situation, to sort of see the public sector as bloated and privileged and everything else. But to your other point there, the lack of strategy over it, we've discussed many times, you know, the people making the decisions about who goes are often from the very tier where you might want to be casting a spotlight. The question is whether that resonates with the broader public.
And tax cuts in a cost of living crisis should be incredibly popular. It's almost like motherhood and apple pie. But you're seeing, because of the fiscal conditions of the government, that from both the left and the right, people are arguing now's not the time to do it, particularly if it's got to be led by debt.
I just disagree with that, because I just go back to Catherine's point about the fact that I do think outside of Wellington, that the public service tax cuts is not cutting through is something they feel is a negative. Mm. And I think that's where, you know, as you say, in many other parts of the country, they're laying off people within their businesses. Therefore, they think that that is what should be happening in Wellington, particularly because of the significant growth that has happened over the last 6 years. Look, and just just secondly, in terms of, you know, tax cuts, once again, I think people, you know, they voted for tax cuts. There was a very clear choice put up on the election about what was happening. They said yes to that. They absolutely have to be reasonably significant, but people are going to be grateful for that money in their back pocket, as opposed to it being seen to be spent more on Wellington bureaucracy.
And this is where the chickens are going to come home to roost, because last year when the policy was announced, up to $250 a week was the headline, and you know the small print was the up to, and we're going to finally see the detail. And you know, those New Zealanders, particularly without children, they could be looking at dollars rather than tens of dollars or hundreds of dollars.
$2, so. $20, whatever. Okay, always a risk in raising expectations around that. However, the Finance Minister has prevailed in delivering them, said she'd resign if she didn't. And they have already had a prolonged debate about whether this is potentially inflationary. They're going to say no because we've made the cuts on the fiscal side of things. That's going to get very interesting, that debate as to whether they still are effectively spending more, even if it's less than the previous government would have. That'll be one for the boffins as well. Not for the boffins. The cut to the first home grants. Now, this clearly affects people saving for their first home, but it also affects, Bridget, mum and dad and bank of mum and dad, who may now find themselves being hit up for another 10 grand. What's the politics around this?
I thought this was really smart politics, because they very clearly, you know, put this, let's call it the political switch up there, which, yes, we're taking away the first home buyer's grant, but we're using that money to fund more social housing, because that is where the pressure is. And I think the modelling does show that whilst, you know, it does slow down, so maybe you won't get into your first home as fast, you will still get there. That still seems to be, you know, and I was actually kind of surprised, frankly, about the lack of noise following the announcement last week. There was a lot of discussion about it, but there wasn't actually a lot of people screaming out that this was going to ruin their lives. So I actually think this was quite smart politics. I think if they just cut it, it absolutely would have been a problem. The fact that they clearly signalled where the money would go and would be getting more people into housing that desperately need to just have a roof over their heads regardless of not owning it, I think that was really smart.
But this is the switcheroo thing. So yes, they're saying it's going to social housing, but at the same time we're seeing the Brightline test reduced to 2 years, which benefits landlords. We've already had the move to restore interest deductibility, which benefits landlords. This is part of the storytelling around budgets. Oh no, this pot of money's for this. I don't know about you, but for many of us, many households, money goes in and money goes out. And where there's a gap, you borrow.
And that's why I almost laughed out loud when you said it was smart politics, Bridget. I mean, first of all, it was incompetently launched when Shane Jones sort of prefigured it and let the cat out of the bag. Remember, 42% of first home buyers accessed this fund last year. So we're not talking about a tiny segment of the population. And as you talked about, Catherine, it's the families as well who are affected by it. But it's that language around Christopher Bishop saying we had to make tough decisions, but it just rings hollow when you've got $2.9 billion for tax breaks for landlords and the Brightline test, and people sort of see through it. And that allegation of hypocrisy, which Kieran McInaldy, I thought, used quite effectively in the House, that just a year ago, National were pressuring the government, the Labor government, why they weren't doing more to promote this.
I think this is, I mean, this is one of the problems that National's going to have, is this continuing characterisation of restoring interest deductibility as a tax cut for landlords, because it's absolutely not. You know, Gareth and I, we just actually discussed...
It's money out of the coffers. It's as simple as that.
But it's also...
This is the Brightline test, by the way.
But it's going back to the fact that actually this is just restoring the same business settings that we all have. Gareth and I were discussing before we came to the studio about managing tax and business. Exactly the same situation. So I do think they've got a narrative issue to deal with, but ultimately this is part of this budget. Remember, this is year one of year three. This is where they're going to make a whole bunch of those hard choices to get rid of the line item so they don't have to fund first home buyers grant into the future years. They're doing the hard choices now.
But it's pretty brutal as well. People who are already in the system will still get the funds, but those people who have been saving diligently for years in a cost of living crisis with no sort of pre-warning or transition period, this is going to be really tough.
The one thing that surprises me a little about this timing, and timing could have been applied with the interest deductibility as well, it could have been phased in slower, but the thing that strikes me about timing is we're right in a sweet spot at the moment for first-time buyers, where they are a greater proportion than for a very, very long time of homes being sold. We've got people, a lot of properties on the market. We've got people losing their jobs in parts of the country who are needing to sell. So right at the time where actually you could see a pretty healthy sweet spot for first-time buyers 10 grand's whipped off them.
But isn't that exactly the point? Is here is a great, you know, more first home buyers are able to get into the market right now. Therefore, it's not the right time for government to be subsidising that.
They might have had the grant though, and now a bunch don't.
Yeah, but I mean, most people buy their houses without the grant, full stop, because they don't, you know, they're not eligible for it. And I do have absolute sympathy for anyone who was, intending applying for the grant last week and suddenly at 1 o'clock it got, you know, the system closed.
Well, thanks that to Shane Jones, you had an extra few hours if you were onto it.
Yeah. I mean, that was definitely harsh, but I do think that absolutely everything you just told us about the market conditions indicates that it's actually easier now than it was even, you know, last year or the year before to get into
a
home.
They could have been heroes. They could have hit 40% of properties going to first home buyers. Look, all right, they've made the case, they've put their argument forward. Let's have a look at the Kāinga Ora review and what is coming out of that. This is the Housing New Zealand review. What was the gist of the English reports, please, Gareth? And then second, what of the government's response? Does one necessarily follow the other?
Well, I think it was a pretty blatantly political report. It was, you know, ostensibly an independent report by the previous Prime Minister. And it was essentially giving ammunition to the government of the day to try and reduce Kāinga Ora's functions, because they have embraced other areas such as progressive home ownership. You know, they've reduced the number of cases that individual managers deal with to provide more wraparound service for Kāinga Ora tenants. So trying to strip back the build, and also, you know, the rationale for this was the debt blowout and the financial viability of Kāinga Ora. But again, Kevin McAnulty in the House retorted immediately, saying that sure, the debt's gone from 3 to 12 billion, but the asset base for the Kāinga Ora property value has gone from $20 to $45 billion. So I thought it was quite breathless and exaggerated, the press conference that Christopher Bishop gave, almost implying that Kāinga Ora was about to fall over or go into bankruptcy. We're talking about, you know, an entity that's got 70,000 plus houses, a huge asset base, doing an essential work for the country, yet this issue of debt has become dominant. And I think it's part of an agenda that National has, and has since the 1950s, to reduce the number of state houses in New Zealand and promote, they used to promote private home ownership, but maybe not anymore. But now the community sector.
Community-based stuff, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it was breathless and highly political, because you've just got to look and, you know, reading through the report, those indications about how, frankly, gross mismanagement and lack of accountability about between the board and management. You know, you talk about it being, you know, that it's really important that we keep this sustainable. The mere fact that the board was preparing, you know, that they would just go over and above the funding agreement with government, that they would just be given no more money no matter what. I mean, frankly, I don't think anyone thinks that taxpayers' money should be managed that way, let alone taxpayers' money that has been given to support our most vulnerable. And to me, that was at the heart of it. I do think the politics in terms of, you know, whether or not it's Kāinga Ora building houses or community housing providers building houses did overtake a little bit. I personally think it's a really good outcome that more community housing providers are there, particularly if it means more houses or more housing placements. But I do think, ultimately, at the heart of the report, and once again, it's probably for the boffins, the accountability and mismanagement, you can't continue an organisation running in that way. And this was a really hard stop, I think, on that happening.
Look, it's also about the support being built around it, which some of the community housing providers do well. But I've been around long enough to be through just about everything two or three times now. We've been there before. They often say, actually, yes, we're up for this, but we need A, B, C, D, E. And the question is whether they will get it, Gareth.
And that's primarily funding and access to capital so they can build the houses or, you know, potentially purchase the houses off if there was a sell down of Kāinga Ora stock. And then the same problem is going to occur to the government, because this liability is on the government's books. And this is what I think the government is so focused on, is that Kāinga Ora debt, which previously was off the books, that has returned onto it, you know, makes the net debt position look worse for the government. But I think, again, this is one of the frustrating things with housing policy in New Zealand, these massive chops and changes between different governments. And we're seeing it once again. One party builds a bunch of state houses and the other party tries to get rid of them or put it to the community sector. And there is a role for the community sector, but they have to be supported.
There is also an argument about the stock, which is move on from the older stock and, you know, develop newer, warmer, insulated stock, right size, right place. Although some of those former state houses went for a pretty penny, didn't they, when they went onto the private market, particularly in Auckland.
One area this has landed very flat, though, is that Bill English's $500,000 payment for this 27-page report, you know, has come out of the emergency housing
fund. It wasn't a good look, was it?
It wasn't a good look.
No. And Bridget's not disagreeing. Okay. MP missteps. David McLeod, first term MP, and his electoral returns. He says, I didn't know that I had to declare 2022. I thought that was done with. That was the bulk of the 170-something thousand. And there was a $10,000 donation in 2023 not declared as well. Is this a first term muck-up? Carelessness?
I definitely think it is a first-term muck-up, and he has taken full responsibility, and I think he'll have some pretty grave consequences for that. You know, the sharp elbows of the government backbenchers, this is not the type of thing you want to push yourself down the promotion, you know, rungs of the ladder, or, you know, this is not the thing you want to be known for. I'd say most people didn't know who David McLeod was outside of New Plymouth, you know, before last week. Unfortunately, this is what he's known for. So I think that is problematic for him. It does seem to be a genuine mistake. However, I do... No, you know, the big parties all have a lot of support structures around, you know, donations, how you're declared, how your expenses are declared. It's something that is, you know, pushed into candidates that they are highly trained on. So it's difficult to see how such a mistake was made.
You know, the other problem at the moment is that this government across all its parties is under considerable scrutiny for those who've donated to it. So when... You know, you've got local people donating to you, and we heard from that local person saying, you know, nothing wrong here, nothing to see here, and fair enough. But when you don't declare who's donated to you, obviously the spotlight comes on.
Yeah.
Absolutely, and especially when you're talking about, you know, 200,000 plus. He only spent 23,000, I think, on the campaign. So quite legitimately, the question now is, well... Where did the rest of the money go? Well, was it spent on the campaign?
23% was spent in the 12 weeks leading up to the election, because that's the expenses you must declare. So let's just be careful on that. It's not to say that there's somehow $180,000 missing.
Oh, I'm not implying that there's any sort of illegality, but the question is, why wasn't that donated to National Party to support the List campaign? Was that spent outside the regulated period? As we're sort of getting this habit now with the influence of big dollars on our politics, that people are spending huge amounts, and this candidate apparently had, you know, big billboards on the way to the airport and lots of promotion. So I think people in New Plymouth did know who he was because of all the massive advertising. But the fact is that for National, the damage here is once again it's raising the issue of money in our politics, cronyism. We also saw this week the Gumboot Friday, the untended $24 million that didn't go through normal procurement processes. You know, Bill English getting $500,000 from the Emergency Housing Fund. It all sort of adds up. Conflated then with the fast track legislation, which he was the chairperson, hearing submissions, and he was receiving donors from seabed miners who are seeking to benefit from this fast track legislation. It's all a bit of a murk, and it all sort of comes together in something that doesn't look particularly good.
Well, that's the problem. Error, if you know, innocent error leads to excessive or certainly vigorous scrutiny. However, the Prime Minister said he's got a way back to Finance Committee. That doesn't help either when you're sitting on the Finance Expenditure Committee, and back to his other roles as well. Darlene Tana, now look, this inquiry is, I don't know how many weeks on now.
I think it's 10,
cleaned out the Greens Leaders Fund. The MP remains on leave on full pay, we understand. When and how is this to be resolved?
Well, I understand it's imminent. So we saw it reported in the media that one of the original claimants in the media refused to be interviewed at the 11th hour, has asked to be interviewed by the lawyer. I've just forgotten her name, unfortunately. But she's declined because the report is imminent. So it should come out soon. And you're right, I understand the Greens have spent about $40,000 from their leader office. That's $40,000 that's not going on research or polling or materials to promote their issues to the public.
But it's also another Green MP under a cloud and, you know, on leave, on full pay. And it just continues to expand this horror run the Greens have had, Bridget.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the question is, yes, the report may be, you know, given to the Greens leaders. The question is, what do they do with it? Because there's obviously a legality question here about, you know, Tana's husband in terms of what he has and hasn't done. You know, are they going to essentially say, you know, we are, you know, no longer endorsing you as a Green MP? Are they, you know, what can they actually do?
It's a very legalistic, likely very legalistic approach to this. They may well feel constrained in what they
can absolutely.
Do.
Absolutely. And I imagine the reason that it's taken 10 weeks is in part because of that, but in part because there is an entire system that actually looks at migrant exploitation and looks at the criminality of it and all of that sort of side of it, which is quite separate to whether or not this MP knew it was involved, you know, whether, you know, her husband hasn't been convicted convicted of anything. I mean, it's very tricky territory.
My point is they may find themselves in a very narrow path of options.
Yeah, I agree. That's exactly. I'm like, what do they actually do with that report? So I don't think the report's actually going to be, you know, the easy way out. But it just, as we saw last week, and it was once again a distraction. I don't even know if it would have actually made the media had the Greens not had this just long story of bad behaviour, alleged bad behaviour, but Ricardo Menendez March dropping the F-bomb in the House. I mean...
Well, on mic.
Mic, yeah,
I'm
exactly.
I'm pretty sure pretty much everyone in the House has dropped it at some point.
Yeah, he's not the first.
No, he's... Well, yeah, I think it was another Greens MP that was the first recorded. Yeah. And I do think, once again, it wasn't something that was major. Most people don't care. And I think it probably just plays into what most people think is happening in the House anyway. But I do think, once again, it's just another story that would have come up. It would have maybe not even made the media had they not had that context.
And you are right, Bridget. With all the horror run the Greens have had this year, you'd think they were sort of trying to be as disciplined as possible and really keep their eye on the ball. And they can't afford to keep making these sort of missteps. Not the hugest thing in the world, but when you've got this festering sore, which is this 10-week Darlene Tana report and all the other problems, you really should be trying to do the best that you can. And it's quite incredible that numerous Green MPs keep saying this is the best caucus we've had ever, or it's the most united we've ever been. There's serious, you know, issues that they've got to grapple with, and I think probably a bit of introspection and asking themselves why is this going on is probably called for.
Okay, thank you both very much. Budget Day it is on Thursday, and we'll be discussing it and other matters obviously next Monday on 9 to Noon Politics.